Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Resting and looking.
And this morning I talked about two qualities in meditation, resting and looking. They're intimately related. They're both very important. Resting doesn't mean sitting still. It doesn't mean holding a posture. It means resting. It's fine to work hard at your practice and to push yourself very, very hard. But only if there's an element of softness in your practice. Once you become hard, there is no quality of resting. And the consequence of that will be that something breaks. It's not terribly good for things to break in practice. They're quite hard, often impossible to repair. I know because I've seen enough of it. Kala Rinpoche used to talk about how they stored liquids in Tibet. Store them in leather bags. Fill a bag with water. And over time, it would become hard. And when it started to become hard, it was in danger of cracking, thus leaking. So when the leather became stiff and hard, before it cracked, it was reworked and became soft. Then you could carry water in it again without fear. Other leather bags were used for carrying butter. The oil and the grease from the butter gradually impregnated the leather. And the leather became very hard and very stiff. But no amount of kneading made it soft. When the bags came to that point, they had to be thrown away. And he said, never let your mind become like that. It's very, very important. So as long as there's an element of softness, of resilience, not just hardness, then it's fine to push in your practice. But when things become hard inside and outside, then it's the time to stop, take a break, rest. Yes?
How do people see that themselves?
It's a very important, how do people see that themselves? It's a very important skill to learn. It's very important to tell when you're pushing too hard and to learn how to back off. And if you have ambition and little things like that in you, those parts of you can continue to run even when you've backed off. So it can get a little tricky. That's why I'm mentioning it. Because I've seen enough of the harm which comes from this, and it's pretty serious. Looking also I mean, resting also doesn't mean just going. There's an awake quality in resting. And that form of resting is a more complete rest than being asleep. Quite literally, it's more restful. So cultivating this relationship with resting is very important. But by itself, it's not enough. You also have to learn to look. Because there's an element of seeing. And you simply can't see if you don't look. Unfortunately, the way most people look falls into two categories, so they're somewhat related. One is to step back and look. Become the observer. This is not conducive at all. In the Mahamudra tradition in which I was trained, we make no use of the observer at all. We regard it as a distraction. I know in other traditions, such as the Gelugpa and the Theravada, it's regarded as very important. We regard it as a distraction. You have to learn how to look while you are in the experience. You aren't looking at the experience. You are looking in the experience. It's a little different. The other problem that many people fall into with looking, we can call the attorney problem. No offense to any attorneys who may be here. I have several in retreat. They regularly take offense, so it works out. And among my students, inexperienced and unskilled attorneys do not know when to stop asking questions. They ask too many questions. That's what often happens with people who look. Because we develop the quality of looking by asking questions. I asked a few questions today that caused you to look in certain ways. But once you're looking, the question doesn't help you do any more. You rest in the looking. That's very important. So, I asked this morning, what experiences all of this? And you look. And it's just like asking, what's that up there? And people don't go, I wonder what that is up there. Don't think about it. You look. And that's the quality that you want in the practice. You look. And then you rest in the looking. Putting those two things together is very, very important. When you can rest in the looking and look in the resting, then you're practicing the perfection of wisdom. Because what do you see when you look? Anybody? What do you say there, Kent? Well, I think you have to go a little further than that. What do you see when you look? Not much.
I mean, there's nothing you can really identify. So just the looking itself.
What do you see when you look? I don't think it is not much. What do you see? Look at your mind. What do you see? Anybody? nothing. You see nothing whatsoever. How long can you look at nothing whatsoever? And I had a painting. I gave it away when I moved my office, but it hung in my office for many years. And when I moved my office, I was putting it up, and the only place that was logical was above my assistant's workstation. And she said, what's that painting, Ken? It's nothing. And it's a piece of minimalist art. It's about this big, and it's a very, very dark green, almost smooth canvas, almost smooth acrylic on canvas, with a tiny bit of unpainted canvas at the bottom. And the green is so dark that most people think it's black. And I said, it's a meditation test. And she said, what? I said, when people can see this painting, they've learned to look at nothing. I said, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Ken. Fast forward 3 years. There's a student of mine who's come quite regularly over these 3 years. He finishes seeing me, comes out to meet with Celia and write a check. And as he's doing so, he says to Celia, when did you get that painting? And Celia looks at me and says, I don't believe this. We turn to the student, and Celia herself says, it's been there all the time, you've been coming. And he says, no. I said, yeah. We put it up when we first moved into the office. Ken said this exactly thing would happen. I didn't believe him, but you just proved he was right. Because when we are looking and we at nothing whatsoever, what do we become? All together now. Nothing whatsoever. Okay? How do you feel about that? No. Most people are scared out of their minds. Yeah. They go, I mean, usually when people see it, as Mumbi was describing earlier on hearing, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is like, let me out of here. 3 seconds ago, please. Yeah. And this is where a capacity in attention is very important. You have to have a sufficient capacity in attention that you can rest in the experience of seeing nothing whatsoever. And all kinds of possibilities come from that. So this looking and this resting, very, very important. Okay, a little bit more of the sutra. So now it comes to the mantra. And the mantra, as someone who's well-versed in these things reminded me, it's pronounced Om Gate Gate Paragate Parasamgate Bodhisvaha. We tend to put the emphasis in English on the penultimate, but it's never on the penultimate in Sanskrit. It's not Ananda, Ananda, it's Ananda. So it's Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisvaha. So it has a very different lilt to it because of that. The mantra is basically a mnemonic. It's a way of memorizing the sutra. I talked about emptiness, take one, take two, take three, take four. And then the last bit is awakening. All Buddhas are three times awakened to unsurpassable true complete awakening. And that's the structure of the mantra. Gate is emptiness, take one. Gate is emptiness, take two. Paragate, which means gone beyond, is emptiness, take three. Parasamgate, which means gone completely beyond, is emptiness, take four, holding on to absolutely nothing. and then there's awakening, bodhi. And svaha is just that, so be it, amen, whatever. Ah, the party. Well, we have got two small things to do before we get to the party. So, Avalokiteshvara says all this, Buddha stirs from his samadhi and says, well done, the son of noble family. Stubborn ox. Yesterday, a smart slap. Today, a handful of hay. Don't expect thanks, Chekhova said. Fair enough. Seeking praise is one thing. Receiving praise is another. Some teachers you just can't please. You bust your ass in practice, you have visions, dreams, and very strange experiences. You tell her about them and ask for help, but all she says is, not good, not bad, keep going. One day you just know and you don't even bother to ask. Later she drops by and you tell her. Now she makes a big fuss. Meanwhile, you're just sitting there saying nothing. Some teachers you just can't please. Thus it is. Thus it is. This is what Buddha says. You look into his eyes. He looks into yours. Whether it's the beginning, the middle, or the end, you know. And you know that he knows, too. Thus it is. And so, everybody's happy. When we come to the conclusion, then Venerable Shariputra and Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, that whole assembly and the world with its gods, humans, titans, and sky spirits rejoiced and praised the words of Lord Buddha. I wanted to say, and praised the words of the Lord, but that has a little different meaning in English. The final accolade. The curtain descends. The party is over. The guests leave, tipping the parking valets as they exchange the usual pleasantries, leaving behind scattered plates of unfinished food and half-empty glasses. Where will they go? What will they do? It's been a long night, and you've probably eaten too much. If anything rattled you, don't throw up. Let it work in you until the you that you are now is fatally poisoned. The importance of conventional life is greatly exaggerated, and a good death can do wonders. Look at this mess. Time to clean up. Put the leftovers outside for those who couldn't come, because they were confused, lost their way, had better things to do, or were detained by the authorities. As for the authorities, may the dark forces of compassion, the black weapon-wielding monsters in tiger-skin kilts and elephant-hide shawls, riding rabid bears and demon horses, correct and complete anything I've left undone. Here's my prayer for you. May you never sleep. May you never eat. May you never go home. May you never find a path. Remember, the reason to know emptiness is to be able to act and rest freely. How do you act? Let the struggles of others be your guide. How do you rest? Let the struggles of others be your guide. So in the short time that we have remaining, I want to talk a little bit about how you live this. Two or three things that I found helpful. The first is that the only thing we have is what we experience. The only thing we can know is what we experience. Anything outside of that is projection or speculation. So, the first thing is to be completely in your experience all the time. When you do that, you find that as we discussed earlier today, there aren't any sentient beings out there. We don't experience any sentient beings. I think it's in the Lankavatara Sutra, maybe one of the other ones. The question is, why do bodhisattvas have infinite compassion for sentient beings? You know what the answer is? Because there aren't any sentient beings. When you open to your experience in this way, however, you become aware of something else, that there are an infinite number of sentient beings. They're not out there. They're inside. We all think the problem is in having a self. It'd be much easier if we had one self. Sadly, we don't have one self. We have tens, hundreds, thousands of selves. And they're engaged in us, all struggling to survive, and each in their own different ways. There's a self which knows everything. There's a self which feels it knows nothing. There's a self which is proud. There's a self which is ashamed. There's a self which can't bear the slightest discomfort. And there's the self which is going to tough things out. It doesn't matter what happened. Anybody else have any of these selves? I just like to check this now and then because sometimes I feel very, very alone. I know. But I have a big predilection for the self that feels alone. Does anybody know of a website called despair.com? Oh, you've got to go to despair.com. You know these motivational posters they have in things? Well, these are demotivational posters. My favorite is a picture of a bear in the middle of the rapids of a river, in which there's salmon jumping up the river, and there's a salmon jumping right in his mouth. And the caption is, "A journey of 1,000 miles can end very, very badly." But the one I'm thinking of shows a lone pine tree on this snowy slope and says, "Do you sometimes have the feeling that you are alone? You are not alone. On the other hand, you are alone, very alone. Anyway, we have all of these selves. Now, each one of these selves arises from being unable to experience something completely in the course of our growing up. They all contain emotionally charged residues of that experience. And when anything comes along which reminds us of one of those experiences, that self pops up and works as hard as it can to dissipate attention so that we don't actually experience anything. You may notice that you only get angry when you feel you are weaker than what you are opposing. So you get angry to get away from that experience of weakness. It doesn't work, of course, but that's what we do. So we have oodles of these, infinite sentient beings. And the best way to describe the relationship among all of these selves is that they're engaged in their own Darwinian struggle for resources. That's what we are. And what we are is the result of the evolution of this particular ecosystem. You thought you had a coherent personality. That's a story we tell ourselves when we go to sleep, but it's not true. You know how I got involved with Buddhism? All is because of a guy in my apartment mate at university called Louis Silcox. I had a scholarship to do graduate work in mathematics in England. My fiancée suggested, it'd be nice to just go traveling around the continent. I thought that would be fun too. So I was mentioning this to Louis one evening, and he just looked at me and said, "MacLeod, you don't have the guts." And that was it. Anybody else have something like that in their history? You know? Without Louis, I wouldn't be here today. You can write thank you notes or notes of revenge, whichever you want. Anyway, so we have all of these selves. And they're struggling one over the other, trying to know, I want to take this care of this situation. Oh, no, we need to do this in this situation. Anybody know this? Oh, okay. This is your world of experience. And most of the time, we're in this one, or that one, or that one, and we move like this. This is called samsara. And we think we know what we're doing all the time. See, it's a lot worse than you thought. These are the six realms. Well, we can divide them up very nicely. You see, just like the traditional diagram. And this is the God's realm, you know. And this is... all of this stuff, you see. And each of the realms has a mantra. You know. You know what the realm, the God mantra for the God's realm is? I'm right. And that's just how it is. So that's it. Now, instead of being locked in this realm, and this realm, and this self, and this self, and this self, and this self, there is another possibility. And that's why I led you through that meditation this morning. We can be in the experience of the whole mess. We can experience the whole mess. Very few people want to do that. Why? Well, number one, it's a mess. And you experience all of that internal conflict and tension and stuff like that. And of course, if you're just opening to the experience of all, you don't get to decide any of it. But when you open to the experience of it all, something very magical happens. Things start to take care of themselves.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.